the fifth kind. If you like our work, and you'd like to know whenever we publish our latest videos, it's really important that you click the bell icon and turn on channel notifications just next to the subscribe button.
Welcome to the Fifth Kind TV. It's our great pleasure today to welcome back a friend of ours, Matt LaCroix. There at Karakadag, we've got the first farm, the evidence of the first farming in our known civilization, and then predating it just down the road is this megalithic structure that seems to be the remnant of a culture that's far older. And so it's a really linchpin part of the world because it's an object lesson in an older developed civilization preceding a new and emergent civilization. So what happened in between people of our design and build being on the planet 200,000 years ago and 10,000 years ago? What were our ancestors doing in the interim?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. And I think the most important point to point out that when we're discussing this is we say, okay, we lay down a foundation of where we can try to put these as moving pieces so we don't lose track of ourselves, right? I think that's what every good researcher who's out there should do is say, okay, that Göbekli Tepe number, let's make that a foundation and boom, we'll put that there. And let's try to put the rest of the pieces together based on that. Because when you get that jigsaw puzzle piece that you find, right? Oh my God, I found the puzzle that it goes in right here. This is where it fits. We should take that as a really serious moment to then say, well, this is a certain chapter. Well, how far back do those chapters go? You know, what is this incredible story that preceded us? Because I think really the ultimate question that comes up is that if we have lost civilizations, ancient civilizations that were destroyed from some great disaster, then how does that redefine our own experience here as a human? How does that redefine how we think of ourselves? If we're not a Darwinian evolved ape that just came from nothing, but our story goes back to all these different epics where knowledge seemed to be imparted and great civilizations emerged that knew aspects of our earth and our energy fields that we don't even know now. It means that those civilizations were in many ways not maybe on a computer level with cars driving around, but I think that it's difficult to measure sophistication. But I think that they were more sophisticated in their understandings of energy and consciousness and understanding ley lines of the earth and how to build structures to harness energy and basically connections to the stars. And we have completely lost track of that due to what you mentioned, which I really believe, and we'll get into some of the evidence here, which is that when you look at ice core samples from Greenland, which gives us a snapshot, only a 20,000-year snapshot, that's the part that's difficult with this, is we only get a 20,000-year snapshot, which isn't a lot if we try to incorporate like a 200,000-year timeline. But what we do get to find out is we say, hey, these tablets and a lot of these ancient stories from cultures around the world speak of a great catastrophe here or multiple great catastrophes that wiped out a past culture. So when was that disaster? And that the most common piece of evidence that we have within that timeline is when we look at soil layers and where they line up on the earth with like this ash layer, basically from extreme burning, where we find all around the world. And then we look at ice core samples and we see, well, wow, look at that snapshot into the climate of our earth over the last 20,000 years. We complain and talk all about how the climate is shifting so rapidly right now and all these things are happening. But when you look over the last 10,000 years, our timeline, according to the best data we have, is that it's barely even a blip in any even minor fluctuation compared to what happened 10 to 12,000 years ago. It's almost something like, when you start to look into it and what the effects that it could have had on Earth, it really is like something out of a Hollywood movie when you start to incorporate the potential.
So when you look at the soil strata, there's this black sedimentary layer that tells us that there were wildfires, maybe sky fires over a huge region of planet Earth at about that time. Does that repeat in the ice core studies?
Yeah, what we find is that our climate shifted so violently that I think the burning of the sediment layer that you mentioned is from a combination of two different things. May have been like literally like massive global wildfires, but also what I think was probably a massive solar outburst from the sun. I think really the reason why the ancient cultures were tracking, well, there's many reasons, but one of the reasons why I think the ancient cultures were tracking the changes with the zodiac and the different ages was that they knew that our sun goes and our Earth, for that matter, go through very distinct changes as the sun goes through what's called a solar maximum to a solar minimum, and then from a solar maximum to a solar minimum, as it goes back and forth. It looks like every 10 to 12,000 years, potentially, there's one of these solar maximum or minimum changes with the sun. And when I look at a timeline of 200,000 years, and we have this disaster lodged right here at 12,000 years ago, it does bring up the question of, well, and I fully understand this. That's why I try to be open about this. But if the Sumerian King List and other ancient tablets are talking about disasters, could that have even been like a previous disaster? We don't really know how many of these disasters have happened over the course of a 200,000-year history that's then wiped out the previous civilization to then have them rebuild. But the one thing I will say, Paul, is that the data we have from 12,000 years ago, and looking at the fact that our Earth was in a massive ice age, where as I'm speaking to you right now in Maine, I had 1 to 2 miles of ice above my head, slowly carving its way around across the landscape. It looks like that ice melted extremely quickly. And when you have those types of events on a magnitude of 2-3 times anything we've ever seen in our recent human history, it really makes you ask the question of, well, did ancient cataclysms wipe out a civilization or civilizations that were in some ways more sophisticated than we are now?
Definitely. Certainly my studies in ancient mythologies, including Genesis, suggest to me that the recollection of a number of planetary resets like that, resets of civilization, are embedded in our ancient memory. And you mentioned sea levels because we can find evidence of cities that would have been last above water about 10,000 years ago. What's interesting about these is that they still look like us. When we find these remains, even Göbekli Tepe, there's a sophistication, as you say, in terms of their knowledge of the stars, their tracking of the Earth's precession. But it still looks like human stone-built structures. So how do you read that? Has it always been human society? Has every reboot been humans, then more humans, or is it a more complicated picture?
I think when we look at something like the Drake equation, which I mention all the time, and we consider how vast the universe is and how many different star systems are in different ages with completely different time periods of when sentient beings could have reached higher states. And when we really look at this larger picture of how vast everything is, to try to think that we're the only ones here that have ever been here and there's never been any influences, I really think that. And I don't necessarily try to just put on a hat that says aliens. I like to think of it in a much more complicated way. I like to think of it as beings, sentient beings throughout the universe, that some have likely traveled here in one way or another. And I think one of the pieces of evidence that is really, really points to that in a very, very strong way. And I know there's naysayers out there that may be listening and saying, come on, really, you're gonna go down that route again? Well, the evidence we get that really points to that starts to point to the fact that there's at least influences outside of here. Some kind of influences are places like Göbekli Tepe, believe it or not. When they were digging down through Göbekli Tepe, they found something really strange. They found that in some of the layers that existed, they found hunter-gatherer tools. They found just like, oh yeah, okay, so the story we're told, right? So they're hunter-gatherers moving through the landscape and learning and as they go along. But then right next to it, out of nowhere, in the layer right next to that same layer or right above it, boom, agriculture just comes out of nowhere. And we're talking about sophisticated agriculture, where so this story that we're told, just to back up a little bit. So we're told that, okay, so hunter gatherers are traveling through the landscape and they find this spot where Göbekli Tepe is, this location, and which is called Potbelly Hill. And they decide that they're going to create one of the most sophisticated astronomical temples ever built in human history for no reason at all. Just there. So it starts to bring up these questions. And then when you look at what I call the megalithic building all around the world, these massive blocks that are created with precision, with stone tools that are impossible that go along with our timeline, Bronze Age, right up through the age we have now with diamond tip blades. Some of these materials, these granites, these volcanic type of basalts that we find from India all the way through into Turkey, down into Petra, Jordan, all around the world, and especially into places like Peru, those types of stones, those rocks cut with that precision would have been impossible. According to the Mohs hardness scale, with the Bronze Age tools and Iron Age tools, with what we're told in human history, it would be like trying to take one of those hammers and chisels and banging it up against one of those Aswan quarry granite, beautiful stones that they built, those incredible monoliths, basically, those out in southern Egypt. You'd be banging on one of those pieces of granite and your tool would literally break in half. It would just disintegrate. The blade would break. So then who carved these tools? I mean, who carved these stones? Why in Aswan, Egypt, in the quarries, are we finding this very strange scoop mark where the rock was literally scooped out? And we're talking about some of the hardest rock in the world, scooped out like it's some kind of a child's Play-Doh. And then these rocks out in Peru, you're looking at places like Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, right across Pumapunku, Tiwanaku. These stones, some of them look like they were literally melted and then molded into place. The point I'm trying to get at is, when you look at just the sophisticated in the design of these structures, the tools that we're told that they were used to build them would have been impossible. Means we know that that's part of a much older civilization. But what really gets me excited, even beyond that, is when I start to get into the heart of these tablets and these ancient writings like you look at, looking at the Book of Enoch, when they clearly talk very extensively about what we refer to much later in religion as things like angels and demons, and how there seem to be these influences and this wisdom that was imparted on certain civilizations. But in many ways, it wasn't even that. They were actually designed in the image of how they wanted those cities to go. And I really quickly, Paul, before you jump in, I want to just mention, there was a great article that just got posted about this tablet called the Cirrus Cylinder. King Cyrus that came out of basically conquered the Iranian Persian area and came in and then conquered Mesopotamia and took over Babylon. In that tablet, it's amazing. Cyrus the Great, he says in that when he conquered Babylon, that he basically bowed down to this god named Bel, who we know was Marduk, which was the chief deity, the god of Babylon. He states in that it's not like he conquered the city and he was king, he could do whatever he wanted. No, the first thing he says in this tablet is that he bowed down to its god Marduk or Bel and basically asked him for how he wanted the city to be ruled and designed in his image. These kings were scared to death of these beings, these gods, as they were called. This is not an archetype out of the human imagination to describe some force of nature or some way that we can describe ourselves. There was definitely influences, and I have a lot of other examples as we go along here, to prove that we were given this knowledge and information and the design of our civilizations behind very specific means.
Definitely. There's so many interesting things happening in that moment, because you just to go back to Göbekli Tepe, there we have an advanced civilization, advanced megalithic civilization, who's constructed this incredible astronomical site, and they seem to be bumping up against a society of hunter gatherers, who then miraculously discover how to genetically modify 11 crops and invent farming. So the possibility that is that you've got one culture informing the beginning of another culture. But then, as you've just referenced, there are these sources that talk about a night and day difference between those who taught and those who learned. And if you listen to the indigenous stories of Native American culture or Aboriginal stories from Australia, they will talk very openly about people having come from somewhere else who are unimaginably more advanced than we are, teaching us the rudiments of life on planet Earth, about food, about medicines, about agriculture. And those stories are open that this is a different kind of being. They're not the survivors of an earlier culture, but they are another kind of being. And what you talk about there with Cyrus is another, for instance. And it seems to me that we find that depicted in ancient carvings all around the world, where we see human kings bowing to these beings who are far larger and clearly superior. It seems to echo through a lot of different cultures.
Yeah, it really does. And it gives existed. Give you an example. When we look at something like probably what is definitely the most famous of all cuneiform tablets, the Epic of Gilgamesh, when you look at murals of Gilgamesh itself, and this is something I love to talk about because it's really quite remarkable. The murals of Gilgamesh, and there's multiple murals of him that show him with this big lion. But in the mural, the lion is the size of a house cat. And what makes that so peculiar is, well, how do you know that's a full-grown lion? Well, if you do just a quick little search online with lions, you know that a lion can only have a mane if it's a mature lion. And so Gilgamesh has this giant lion, one of the largest cats in the world, and it's sitting on his lap, and it's no bigger than a house cat. Over and over and over again, it seems like these kings like that are mentioned in the Sumerian king list and Epic of Gilgamesh and Atrahasis, they're talking about time periods that are so long ago that we don't even represent the same age or height that they even were around. And give me an example. In all the way across in the Americas, when they first started excavating what are known as these serpent burial mounds in the Mississippi Valley of the United States with a lot of these ancient indigenous cultures, they found, I think it's something like at least half a dozen or more of these giant skeletons that were been buried in these mounds that were almost like representing like a dirt pyramid. And as you travel further south, you find those same mounds in Mexico, but they get bigger and bigger and bigger, like from Guadalajara southeast until you get into the Aztec. And then all of a sudden they turn into pyramids. Like there was different levels of knowledge given to different cultures at different times. And they were all trying to mimic each other and pay homage to what seemed like these great lineage of heroes and what we would refer to as giants, like what is mentioned in the Book of Genesis, talking about these great giants that were once here long ago and they were no longer here anymore. One of the things I love to bring up every time is that one of the greatest pieces of evidence that proves that giants were real was looking at the story of, when people were sailing around the ocean, discovering different places, the famous sailor Magellan, the Straits of Magellan off of South America, Patagonia. Go look into the story of Magellan, but not the story that we're given in books. Do a little research into his route and what they discovered along that route. When he was sailing through the Straits of Magellan, they went ashore to get supplies. And in the notes that were written by his number one man, his in command, it was basically recording all the events on this journey. They would have basically a notepad where they would write down each day what they saw, what they encountered, and they would file it all and then bring it back home. Well, some of those records were buried and no one ever heard of them again, because when Magellan came back, he brought these stories with him of how when they went inland around Patagonia, they encountered giant men over 10 feet tall in some cases, and some of them were really violent, and they were forced to go back in their ship and sail back home. But why aren't any of those stories in our books? Well, clearly there's a history that goes back that includes ancient lineages and ancient bloodlines that seem to be either not present today or in such a muted way that there's only just little remnants of them that still exist, I think.
It's fascinating, isn't it? We have references like that from Magellan. We find it in Egyptian carvings. We find it in Sumerian carvings. There are some really interesting finds in North America, remains of giants in the 1800s. How did it become so controversial? Because who was it? It was a speech by Abraham Lincoln, wasn't it, making reference to the giants who used to live in that land, in that region he was standing in. Evidently, we still have remains that were found at that time. They're all archived somewhere in the Smithsonian. Today, though, it seems to be you're labeled as fringe if you want to shine any light on this. So if you want to talk about it, why is it controversial? And why do we not have reams and reams of the results of DNA testing on the finds that do exist, including the tomb of Gilgamesh that they found in Iraq in 2003?
We live in a situation right now, and I sometimes I try to envision the place we're in in terms of a social conditioning level. We've been conditioned to a point now where we exist in a reality where if you try to challenge anything that goes along with this mainstream view, it doesn't even have to be giants. It could be anything, even just these megalithic structures around the world and their age and how they're older. Anything that challenges this doctrine of history that we've been taught, you are immediately labeled as a conspiracy theory / nut job. And this is a way to very decisively shut out those voices that are trying to objectively figure things out. Because think about it, right? You go into a room full of people and you start to bring up some of these ideas, right? Did you know, right, that in the 1800s, in the Wisconsin Telegraph or whatever it was, they reported that they uncovered this 9-foot skeleton in this mound? You bring that up to a party, right? Everyone's like, no, I didn't know that. That's amazing. Then you go, did you also know that the Smithsonian, supposedly all of these skeletons have disappeared and no one's ever seen them again and none of this was researched? All of a sudden, those eye rolls are going to go. Boom. You have triggered the undiscussable, the forbidden knowledge that goes against this doctrine we've been taught. And people have been so conditioned that they don't even think that way. They don't go, oh, here it goes. Quick, put the brakes on. I can't think about this. It's so ingrained that it just happens without even knowing it. And that's the way that most people view this type of information, is that you're not even allowed to talk about it. You're not even allowed to discuss it because it's impossible. It's not even out there. So how did this all come to be? Well, you got to walk down that conspiracy road, because really, the more you look at it, the more the evidence is almost screaming and shouting to be seen. And what we find is that there have been powerful secret societies throughout history, and some of them have managed to seize control of massive amounts of information. One of those places where that information was hijacked was during the Roman Empire. In the city of Constantinople, Constantine, the great emperor of the Roman Empire, he decided, hey, it would be pretty smart if we could just write whatever history timeline we wanted to and then give that to the people as what happened. And you start to see that there's a lot of these aspects of religion, and also looking at it more of as a spiritual side of religion and what we are as a conscious being, but also just the timeline of history and what these events and where they landed. That whole timeline has been so skewed and so manipulated that we really have a very, very misunderstood and almost lost understanding of this incredible epic or epics that preceded us. And I think that when you start to open up that rabbit hole of, well, you go down, you start to ask a few questions, before you know it, this history unfolds before us that really opens up those really big questions, Paul, like you brought up. And this is how simple it gets. If ocean levels, go ahead.
No, carry on.
If ocean levels were 400 feet lower before the last ice age melted, and we have cities that are underwater, it means that those cities were built before ocean levels rose. It gets as simple as that.
It's that simple.
There are so many holes, Paul, and I just want to end up by saying there are so many holes that as we start to piece these together, we find that it's almost a mountain of information that's being held back instead of just a little molehill.
Yes, I think the study of history is just so important. I think right now in Australia, they are prioritizing degrees in maths and engineering. There's spaces for that. There's money for that. But it's going to cost you twice that amount if you want to study history. Well, in my book, studying history is vitally important. And you don't have to study too much history to understand how governing powers want to control the narrative. The ones in charge want to tell you what is the real news and the fake news. You know, that's been obvious when we've looked at other cultures, the Soviet Union. We used to laugh at their official news agency telling everyone what was fact and everything else was conspiracy. We're kind of all in that same boat, but the Roman Empire are a great object lesson in how this works. And there's an amazing moment after the time of Constantine when Emperor Theodosius illegalized all religions outside of Christianity. And that meant archiving or destroying all the other narrative traditions, rounding up old priesthoods so that they couldn't operate anymore. And so deliberately shutting down other layers of history and story and interpretation. And when you read the story of Theodosius, it's easy to recognize other versions of the same thing happening in other cultures. It's such a history is a wonderful thing because it allows us to be more open-eyed as we look at what's happening in the world around us. I think for me, my advantage is being a bit older. And so I've seen enough moments in history where the official story of what happened clearly has left some facts out. And you've only got to come across one story of, oh, actually, we now know that isn't what happened, before you're beginning to give yourself permission to say, I'm going to question some other stories as well. I do think, though, we're in a cultural moment when more people are willing to say, yes, I'm not sure what I think about that. I'm not sure if I really do believe that. It can be dismaying. I mean, you were talking what happens when you say, oh, there's this stuff at the Smithsonian that's been buried or gotten rid of, and people roll their eyes and say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, I can now ignore you. Yes, there is a lot of that. But I do think we're at a moment in the story of our culture where we're waking up a bit and saying, no, I really do want to know what happened. I'm not just going to go with the Disney version of our history at that point. But bring us to another moment on your timeline that you think is a real pivot and has got some time bomb information in it.
Sure. I guess we did talk about a lot of areas sort of jumbled, so I'll try to go back and we get some order here. Just quickly as I run through this, looking at cities like Lagash, Bad Tabir, and Shurupek that are mentioned on the Sumerian king list, we get some interesting data where it talks about how those cities were then destroyed by great disasters and catastrophes like we mentioned. But one of the things that is important is that when we look at stories of Atlantis, and we look at how Atlantis was destroyed and knowledge had to be preserved somewhere, and then cultures like the ancient Egyptians at Akemet or Chem, all of a sudden these incredible pyramids were built and all of this understanding of the electromagnetic grid and energy ley lines. When we look at the fact that these disasters seem to be these global disasters, and these structures seem to be built on these precise energy ley lines of where balancing our planet is, it brings up the question of whether or not these structures were built to just simply harness energy and raise human consciousness, or whether or not they could even have built as a way to try to balance our planet to prevent these destructive events to occur. So I put down the pyramids of Kemet, Egypt, in the location right before the deluges and the destruction of our world, because when we look at how the dynastic Egyptians came in and then wrote all their hieroglyphics on all the, you know, the great temples and a lot of the structures there, but they took essentially took credit for their creation. we say, okay, so there, so instead of looking at this in a one-way linear way, instead of saying there's an ancient Egyptian culture and there's an ancient Mesopotamian culture, what about if there's different periods of those cultures, right? So when we look at something like the pre-Inca, the Inca that built these incredible structures like in Machu Picchu, and then you see how right on top of them, there's these very this very primitive mortar building which lacked all the sophistication of their ancestors. So that tells you that, okay, so instead of saying Inca, there are multiple versions of different epics even within that culture alone.
Go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full interview.